It is really a delight for me to deliver this introduction. Ada is, as we've already heard, a real poetry rock star. She's the author of 5 books of poetry, including Bright Dead Things, which was a finalist in 2015 for the National Book Award, a finalist for the Kingsley Tufts Poetry Award, and a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. Her most recent collection, The Carrying, was published just in August of 2018, and it has been named one of the top 5 poetry books of the year by the Washington Post. I've known Ada for almost 20 years. That does not seem possible. I'm a late bloomer, and she and I were graduate students together at NYU. I've been thinking recently about that time in our lives and about a reading that Ada gave when we were both still living in New York. She was reading from her second book, This Big Fake World, which must just have been released, I think, at that time. It might have been 2005. Anyway, she was reading in a very rowdy bar, which is pretty much how things went back then. It was called The Four-Faced Liar, and the place was just packed with people who knew and adored her. I remember thinking that I was hearing something so unlike anything I had heard before, something that seemed alchemical, a sequence of narrative poems that offer up characters that are both somehow anonymous and also nearly surreal, including a recurring character who gets drunk and writes letter after letter to Ronald Reagan. These are funny poems, but they're also incredibly moving. The world she created in that book is, as one of the central images in the book suggests, as absolutely ordinary, wonderful, and fragile as a snow globe. And that idiosyncratic sensibility, the mind that created those poems, plain-spoken, self-deprecating, accessible, yet also deeply contemplative, passionate, and compassionate, is for me at the core of all of her work. A few weeks ago, one of my colleagues said to me that students come away from Ada's poems with the misunderstanding that writing poems that good might be as easy as talking seriously to a friend on the phone. And it's true. Ada's poems make being open to the varied experiences of our mortal human experience seem simpler than it is. To be clear, there's nothing one-dimensional about these poems or this poet. These are poems that often pull us into sorrow and grief and disappointment, though they also pull us into the sanctity of authentic bewilderment. To borrow one of her own titles, they instruct us on how to be rewilded, which seems to not only be a kind of return to innocence, but also a return to a potentially dangerous primal hunger, a hunger of the body and the soul. Matthew Zapruder has called Ada Limón an everyday symbolist, a high-level duende enabler, and I think that that description says better than I ever could what kind of fabulous trickster poems had me in their grasp so long ago. Last year, Ada collaborated with the poet Natalie Diaz on a series of epistolary poems that were published in The New Yorker. And in an interview with Kevin Young, Diaz said that from the moment she received Ada's first poem letter, she knew that the work that would pass between them would require a kind of intimacy that Diaz felt she had never been aesthetically required to produce before. And that, too, feels right to me. For these are poems that demand that their readers stand very close to something urgent. I'm currently teaching an undergraduate class. A lot of my students are out there, called Singing America, and it's about 21st century poetry. And I'm pretty sure that all of the students in that class want Ada Limón to be their Valentine. So that's the highest praise that I can think of. Please welcome Ada Limón.
Hi. How are you? Happy Valentine's Day. Or in my family, happy my mother's birthday. She's what it's called. Thank you for that reading, Sarah. That was beautiful. It's such a pleasure to be here. And I recently listened to this wonderful podcast who had one of my favorite poets on. And I was listening and cleaning the house and being very enamored by this wonderful conversation between two women I admired. And then they got to this part where they started talking about how they hated love poems. And they thought, you know, and she said at one point, I mean, I would never write love poems. And all I kept thinking, I had to sort of sit down and think, I think every poem I've ever written is a love poem. And I'm probably just going to continue to write love poems for the rest of my life. So I thought maybe what I would do is read 10 poems, and I'm pretty sure every single one of them, in one way or another, is a love poem. I'm going to start with a poem for my mother, because it's her birthday, and because she's my mother. And I think that this is a poem for that mother-daughter connection that comes in many shapes and forms, but in this case, I think, is a very caring one. The Raincoat. When the doctor suggested surgery and a brace for all my youngest years, my parents scrambled to take me to massage therapy, deep tissue work, osteopathy, and soon my crooked spine unspooled a bit. I could breathe again and move more in a body unclouded by pain. My mom would tell me to sing songs to her. The whole 45-minute drive to Middle Two Rock Road and 45 minutes back from physical therapy. She'd say that even my voice sounded unfettered by my spine afterward. So I sang and sang because I thought she liked it. I never asked her what she gave up to drive me or how her day was before this chore. Today, at her age, I was driving myself home from yet another spine appointment, singing along to some maudlin but solid song on the radio, and I saw a mom take her raincoat off and give it to her young daughter when a storm took over the afternoon. My God, I thought. My whole life, I've been under her raincoat, thinking it was somehow a marvel that I never got wet. Sorry, this is emotional all of a sudden. Poems about moms. Thank you. I tried to read some poems about her with her in a room once, and I was like, oh, this is not a good idea. I'll never recover. This is a love poem. Sometimes poems come to you in different ways. This one came to me with the sound of trash bins rolling out to the curb. You know how it almost sounds like a train going by? So this is how the poem started. Dead stars. Out here, there's a bowing even the trees are doing. Winter's icy hand at the back of all of us, black bark, slick yellow leaves, a kind of stillness that feels so mute it's almost in another year. I am a hearth of spiders these days, a nest of trying. We point out the stars that make Orion as we take out the trash, the rolling containers, a song of suburban thunder. It's almost romantic. As we adjust the waxy blue recycling bin until you say, man, we should really learn some new constellations. And it's true, we keep forgetting about Antlia, Centaurus, Draco, Lacerta, Hydra, Lyra, Lynx. But mostly we're forgetting we're dead stars too. My mouth is full of dust, and I wish to reclaim the rising, to lean in the spotlight of streetlight with you toward what's larger within us, toward how we were born. Look, we are not unspectacular things. We've come this far, survived this much. What would happen if we decided to survive more, to love harder? What if we stood up with our synapses and flesh and said no, no to the rising tides? Stood for the many mute mouths of the sea, of the land. What would happen if we used our bodies to bargain for the safety of others, for Earth, if we declared a clean night, if we stopped being terrified, if we launched our demands into the sky, made ourselves so big people could point to us with the arrows they make in their minds, rolling their trash bins out after all of this is over. Thank you. See, love poems. They're all love poems. I would say it's a love poem for a stranger. Wonder Woman. Standing at the swell of the muddy Mississippi after the urgent care doctor had just said, well, sometimes shit happens. I fell fast and hard for New Orleans all over again. Pain pills swirled in the purse along with a spell for later. It's taken a while for me to admit I am in a raging battle with my body. A spinal column 35 degrees bent, vertigo that comes and goes like a DC Comics villain nobody can kill. Invisible pain is both a blessing and a curse. You always look so happy, said a stranger once as I shifted to my good side, grinning. But that day, alone on the riverbank, brass blaring from the steamboat Natchez, out of the corner of my eye, I saw a girl, maybe half my age, dressed for no apparent reason as Wonder Woman. She strutted by in all her strength and glory, invincible, eternal, and when I stood to clap, because who wouldn't have? She bowed and posed like she knew I needed a myth, a woman by a river, indestructible. Thank you. I'm going to read another poem for my mother because it is the day of her birth. I talked to her today and I said, you know, lots of women are, you know, doing amazing things in their 70s. And she said, yes, and they make me vomit. It was amazing. I was talking about, you know, did you see the Grammys and Diana Ross and did you see Cher and all this stuff? And she's like, mm-hmm. My mother is an artist and she's done all the covers of every book I've made. That's one of the best collaborations I've had in my life. This poem is written because I have a poem in Bright Dead Things that talks about why I don't have any tattoos. And then when I came to The Carrying, which is my fifth book, I realized that I was lying about why I don't have any tattoos. And this is the real reason. The real reason I don't have any tattoos is not my story to tell. It's my mother's. Once, walking down Bedford Avenue in my 20s, I called her as I did, as I do. I told her how I wanted a tattoo on the back of my neck, something minor but permanent. And she is an artist. I wanted her to create the design, a symbol, a fish I dream of every night, an underwater talisman, a mother's gift on my body. To be clear, I thought she'd be honored. But do we ever really know each other fully? A silence like a hospital room. She was in tears. I swore that I wouldn't get one, wouldn't let a needle touch my skin, my arm, my torso. I'd stay me, my skin, the skin she welcomed me into the world with. It wasn't until later that I knew it wasn't so much the tattoo, but the marking, the idea of scars. What you don't know, and this is why this is not my story, is that my mother is scarred from burns over a great deal of her body. Most from an explosion that took her first child she was carrying in her belly. Others from the skin grafts where they took skin to cover what needed it. She was in her late 20s when that happened, outside her studio in the center of town. You have to understand, my mother is beautiful. Tall and elegant, thin and strong. I have not known her any other way. Her skin that I mapped with my young fingers, its strange hardness in places, it patterns like quilts here, riverbeds there. She's wondrous, preternatural, survived fire, the ending of an unborn child. Heat and flame and death all made her into something seemingly magical. A phoenix S. What I know now is she wanted something else from me.
for me to wake each morning and recognize my own flesh, for this thing she made, me, to remain how she intended, for one of us to make it out unscathed.
Thank you. I made it through that one without crying. It's hard. I read that poem because I was thinking about what kind of ownership we have over stories. This is a poem about a time when my husband and I were trying to have a child. And that sort of wild seesaw that fertility treatments create in the body and in the mind. And I couldn't not write about this subject because I was so fascinated by it, that we were living in a duality at all times. And do you know that game, Would You Rather? Okay. Yeah, I was playing it with Sasa here, my niece, and Nash. We were talking about Would You Rather, and then that stuck with me, and then this poem came out of it. Would you rather? Remember that car ride to SeaTac? How your sister's kids played a frenzied game of Would You Rather, where each choice tick-tocked between superpowers of towering piles of food too often denied. Would you rather have fiery lasers that shoot out of your eyes or eat Sundays with whipped cream for every meal? We dealt it out quick without stopping to check ourselves for the truth. We played so hard that I got good at the questions, learned there had to be an equality to each weighted ask. Now I'm an expert at comparing things that give the illusions that equal each other. You said our plan B was just to live our lives. More time, more sleep, travel. And still, I'm making a list of all the places I found out I wasn't carrying a child. At the outdoor market in San Telmo, Isla Negra's wild iris of sea, the baseball stadium, the supermarket, the Muhammad Ali Museum. But always the last time tops the list. The middle of the Golden Gate Bridge, looking toward Alcatraz, a place they should burn and redeliver to the gulls and cormorants, common daisies, and seagrass. Down below the girder, that's still not screened against the jumpers, so that it seems almost like a dare, an invitation. We watched a seal making a sinuous shimmy in the bay. Would you rather? Would I rather? The game is endless and without a winner. Do you remember how the seal was so far under the deafening sound of traffic, the whir of wind mixed with car horns and gasoline, such a small speck of black movement alone in the churning waves between rock and shore? Didn't she seem happy? I think that's a love poem for the now, for that seal, wherever she is. Happy. This is another love poem. You can really tell this podcast really got to me. I couldn't believe it. I never would write a love poem. I thought, oh, wow. I don't know what to do with that information. This poem also deals with infertility, but it's a love poem really and truly for being an artist. And I know so many of you are writers in this room and are practicing the craft. And yeah, this is a love poem for that. Carrying. The sky is white with November's teeth, and the air is ash and wood smoke, a flush of color from the dying tree, a cargo train speeding through, and there, that's me, standing in the wintering grass, watching the dog suffer the cold leaves. I'm not large from this distance, just a fence post, a hedge of holly. Wider still, beyond the rumble of overpass, mares look for what's left of green in the pasture. A few winglings kick out, and theirs is the same sky, white like a calm flag of surrender pulled taut. A few farms over, there's our mare, her belly barrel round with foal, or idea of foal. It's Kentucky, late fall, and any mare worth her salt is carrying the next potential stakes winners. Ours, her coat thicker with the season's muck, leans against the black fence, and this image is heavy within me. How my own body, empty, clean of secrets, knows how to carry her.
knows we were all meant for something.
Thank you. And I'm going to read, I think that was six, so four more poems. Read a love poem for my husband. Has anyone here seen a horse being born? A few. If you have, you know it's a very odd thing. They just pop out and there's like another horse. Oh. I haven't recovered from it. This is a love poem that uses that moment. What I didn't know before was how horses simply give birth to other horses. Not a baby by any means, not a creature of liminal spaces, but already a four-legged beast hell-bent on walking, scrambling after the mother. A horse gives way to another horse, and then suddenly there are two horses. Just like that. That's how I loved you. You off the long train from Red Bank, carrying a coffee as big as your arm. A bag with two computers swinging in it unwieldy at your side. I remember we broke into laughter when we saw each other. What was between us wasn't a fragile thing to be coddled, cooed over. It came out fully formed, ready to run. Another complicated love poem. Before I got married, I had a lot of issues with the word wife. It seemed so, like, cuff. Wife. I'm not yet comfortable with the word. It's short, clean whoosh that sounds like life. At dinner last night, my single girls said in admonition, "It's not wife approved," about a friend's upcoming trip. Their eyes rolled up and over out of their pretty young heads. Wife, why does it sound like a job? I want a wife, the famous feminist wrote, a wife who will keep my clothes clean, ironed, mended, replaced when need be. A word that could be made easily into made. A wife that does, fixes, soothes, honors, obeys, housewife, fishwife, bad wife, good wife. What's the word for someone who stares long into the morning, unable to even fix tea? The kettle steaming over loud like a train whistle. She who cries in the mornings. She who tears a hole in the earth and cannot stop grieving. The one who wants to love you but often isn't even good at that. The one who doesn't want to be diminished by how much she wants to be yours. Thank you. And two more poems. What will they be? Another love poem. Because all poems are love poems. I'll just keep saying it over and over again. The elegy, love poem. Always. For those of you that are writers, you understand this moment where you are creating and the whole world around you disappears. And then for those of you who have ever had a relationship with a writer, you understand that moment when for them the whole world disappears and you're like, but I need some answers and I need your attention. I had this moment where my husband and I, you know, I travel a lot and I have this, you know, real joy and honor of giving readings at places, and I try to look nice at these things. I try. And my husband was like, you look great. I saw those pictures on Facebook and this and that. And I thought, oh yeah, because when I'm home, I'm just wearing sweatpants. So I realized, I told him the first line came from something I actually said to him. The title is Love Poem with Apologies for My Appearance. Sometimes I think you get the worst of me. The much-loved loose forest green sweatpants, the long braless days, hair knotted and uncivilized, a shadowed brow where the devilish thoughts do their hoofed dance on the brain. I'd like to say this means I love you. The stained white cotton t-shirt, the tears, pistachio shells, the mess of orange peels on my desk. But it's different than that. I move in this house with you the way I move in my mind, unencumbered by beauty's cage. I do like I do in the tall grass, more animal me than much else. I'm wrong. It is that I love you. But it's more that when you say it back, lights out, a cold wind through curtains, for maybe the first time in my life, I believe it. Thank you. And actually, I'm going to make this, I think this poem is a love poem for the country. So I'm going to do this poem. Thank you so much for having me and for being here on Valentine's Day. Or as we say, my mother's birthday. A new national anthem. The truth is, I've never cared for the national anthem. If you think about it, it's not a good song. It's too high for most of us with the rocket's red glare. And then there are the bombs. Always, always, there is war and bombs. Once I sang it at homecoming and threw even the tenacious high school band off key. But the song didn't mean anything, just a call to the field, something to get through before the pummeling of youth. And what of the stanzas we never sing, the third that mentions no refuge could save the hireling and the slave? Perhaps the truth is every song of this country has an unsung third stanza. Something brutal snaking underneath us as we blindly sing the high notes with a beer sloshing in the stands, hoping our team wins. Don't get me wrong. I do like the flag. How it undulates in the wind like water, elemental, and best when it's humbled, brought to its knees, clung to by someone who has lost everything. When it's not a weapon, when it flickers, when it folds up so perfectly you can keep it until you need it, until you love it again, until the song in your mouth feels like sustenance, a song where the notes are sung by even the ageless woods, the short grass plains, the Red River Gorge, the fistful of land left unpoisoned, the song that's our birthright, that's sung in silence when it's too hard to go on, that sounds like someone's rough fingers weaving into another's, that sounds like a match being lit in an endless cave, the song that says, my bones are your bones, and your bones are my bones, and isn't that enough? Thank you.